Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I investigate what is emerging as a real spiritual culture in this country and around the world. And tonight's guest is part of that tradition. He's part of a ancient tradition of shamans, and he's going to be talking to us about his teachings, the teaching of his lineage, his father. And his name is Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. Don Miguel, you there?
Hi, how are you?
Good, good, good. I talked to your father a couple of months ago about his work, and tell me a little bit about how you differ from what he's doing, or how did he pass this lineage on, and just the relationship as a teacher to your father.
Oh, no problem, Alan. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, the main difference is that he is him and I am me.
Okay.
Basically, why that is that the way we learn in our tradition is that we learn through experience. Right? Like, for example, my father, the way he taught me to face my fear is that when I was young, he grabbed me and threw me into a pool in order to learn how to swim. And without me, he basically just, when I was in the water, just doing my best to try to just keep my head above water, like, Dad, help me. I can't swim. Miguel, your head is above water. You're swimming.
What?
And so in that kind of situation, it's like my father constantly and my grandmother constantly always pushed me into places where I had to really face it. Either I had to swim or I drown.
And swim, you know, or sink, yes.
Exactly. You know, basically, yeah. You know, it's like another way, it's like the way my dad taught me how to speak in public was, you know, when I was 14 or 15, he would be talking to a big crowd, and all of a sudden he'd ask me to come up on stage and start talking without any warning, without anything. Just says, all right, start talking. And just allow your inspiration to come in. Whatever comes out is great.
So any fear you had, he would just throw you into your fear, huh?
Exactly. You know, and with my grandmother, the way she taught me is that she didn't speak any English. She spoke Spanish. And she always had, you know, did healings and lectures and workshops herself. And the majority of the crowd would be coming would be in English. So I would translate for her. And in learning how to speak her words, I had to completely shut myself out, my own mind, and just basically listened exactly what as she's saying it. And if I ever had a question or a thought, I know that it would trip me, you know, because I would lose a whole sentence. Because my grandmother, you know, at the very beginning, she would be slow, 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 and then all of a sudden she just pick up speed and she won't stop. And basically that's how I was taught. So my father, his teachers, my grandpa, my grandmother, his grandfather, and a different Nahual in the desert of Sonora pushed him in the same way. So even though we both learned similar ways, we're different simply because we had the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And being my father, a medical doctor, he had a different words in order to describe his experience, where I had a total set of different rules.
Well, tell me a little bit about the lineage. How far does this, your particular tradition, go back?
Like, well, you have to consider the fact that we only know up until Don Ezequiel. And before that, there were always stories of our great-great-great-grandfather and such. So the only one that was physical memory of was Don Ezequiel, which is my grandmother's grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And which is very important, because after that, all the stories we have are stories. Yes, we know that we are descendants from the Aztecs and Toltecs, and we come from a lineage of Eagle Knights. But, you know, we always have to take it with a grain of salt. They are stories. And even though our family keeps saying, yes, we're descendants of that, we always have to always be skeptical.
Right, I understand. But what was the last thing you said?
Well, we have to learn how to be skeptical, but we have to learn how to listen.
Right, but what was the kind of knowledge that was passed down? That's the thing I'm interested in, you know?
Well, a lot of, like I said before, like the way I was taught, the way my father was taught, it was the way my grandmother and my great-grandfather were taught, you know, by experience. We come from a Toltec lineage, mostly the Eagle Knights. But what a Toltec means, really, is an artist, someone who creates life and creates art. You know, but basically it's the same concept as that in our point of view, the whole world is filled with Toltecs. The only difference between our culture is that in our culture we call now a Toltec an artist. In English we call a Toltec an artist. In Spanish we call a Toltec an artista. And I don't know what other language has it, but if you pay attention to it, like the whole world has these incredible individuals who are masters of their life and can create the most beautiful art, the most beautiful teachings, the most beautiful knowledge. The only difference between us and them is that the language we use. And, of course, we learn from our experiences and our ancestry.
But was there a particular thing? I mean, I know you learned a different way from your father, but there were the specific different rituals that were also passed down to you in part of this Toltec lineage?
Well, sometime in the mid-1990s, my father, he learned a lot of these rituals. And we found that a lot of people were getting too hung up on the rituals. They were more interested in the rituals than in the lessons. So my father gave himself the challenge to clean the tradition as much as he can, to free it as much as he can from fanaticism. So, you know, if you look at the books Beyond Fear and then look at the book The Four Agreements, in Beyond Fear, you can see a lot of the shamanism, a lot of the mystic side of our traditions. And my dad saw that people were losing the lesson because they were so stuck in the tradition and the mythology and all that, that they were completely missing out. So he challenged himself to clean it as much as he can to bring it down to common sense. Because from common sense, you can speak to anyone. So when you read The Four Agreements, it's a huge shift from Beyond Fear, the way he used to talk about Tezcatlipoca, the stories of Quetzalcoatl, the ceremonies to face fear, to face death. All these ceremonies that when my dad used to teach, he basically just shed like a snake. Simply because, you know, like it was the equivalent of Dungeons and Dragons. People would go into the classes, people would be wanting the lessons, but they were wanting the role play. I want to play the mystic. I want to play the spiritual person. I want to play the shaman. And my father was saying, well, you're missing the point. All of these things are tools. And then if you use that concept all around the world, like, you know, in China, in India, in Europe, and Native American, in Japan, basically all the masters begin to teach and try to take out the mythology. And those apprentices that can go beyond mythology to see it as practical as everyone is, we go back to common sense. So you can see that with the Four Agreements and the Mastery of Love in my father's books, it's like we're trying to teach from that point of view. So much that for me, when I started learning, my apprenticeship was really facing a whole different world, because the ceremonies that happen in the Toltecs, the ceremonies that we followed, well, they get lost in the translation.
I see. But, you know, I'm only referring to that because I'm reading the Carlos Castaneda books. He talks about specific rituals that actually bring energy. They're not just senseless rituals, but they're things that in his
They're not senseless, of course. They're not senseless. They're always mean a great purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a huge difference, you can say, where Carlos Castaneda opened up the doors to these worlds. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible experience, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s, to be able to teach the lessons of Don Juan. You know, because you can almost see Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda as the translator of an old ancient culture, you know, from the teachings that Don Juan learned through the Sonoran Desert, and Carlos Castaneda being able to be translated. Because you have to also understand that the lessons we get from Carlos Castaneda is the filtered is the filter from Don Juan.
Right.
You know,
right,
basically,
right, right.
Carlos Castaneda experienced his experiences, and mm-hmm. only Carlos Castaneda knows that. And he did his best to share it with all of us.
Yeah.
And that's the wonderful thing.
Yeah. But how does your tradition differ from that as a, you know, a Toltec Nahual tradition? You know, you're not.
Well, our biggest. I would say that the only biggest difference we have is the use of drugs. We don't use drugs.
Like
we don't use
plants.
Yeah, we don't use the plants. We stay away from that. We mostly go for what's it called? Discipline. Learning how to control the mind and learning how to discipline. Because it's very easy to go through the plants. But to learn how to control the mitote, to control our attention, to focus on one point and have it doing it without any aid, to do it just like that and be able to achieve that moment of not having to interpret everything, but seeing life as is. Seeing life as is and being able to articulate, to produce, to achieve, to go beyond our own limitations, to go beyond fear, to go beyond the limitations of our belief system.
Right, right. That really brings you up to date as a contemporary shaman, Toltec. So you're writing the book, The Fifth Agreement, because, you know, the first four agreements. Do you want to just review the first four and tell us what the fifth agreement is?
Well, the first four are don't take anything personal.
Yeah.
Be impeccable with your word. Don't make assumptions and always do your best.
Right.
My brother, Jose Luis, is writing the book, The Fifth Agreement, which is called Be Skeptical but Learn to Listen. Basically, my dad gave us all of his apprentices, he had one basic rule at the beginning of all our apprenticeships. Three parts. First part, don't believe anything I say, but learn to listen. Somewhere in what I say lies the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest rule to follow. The second rule is, don't believe yourself, but learn to listen. Somewhere in what you say lies the truth. And that one's very difficult because we're so attached to our own story, to our own beliefs. But if you understand the first one, the first two, then you can understand the third part of that rule, which is don't believe anyone else, but learn to listen. Somewhere in what they say lies the truth. And the reason why is that, well, don't believe me, don't believe yourself, don't believe anyone else, is that as everyone, as individuals, even if you were raised in the same family, we learn different. We understand things differently. Why? Because we all have our own point of view. We filter the information, we process information in our own way. But if you learned to listen, you can hear past that filter. You can hear that the truth coming. And in order for that to happen, one example is, if someone's talking to you, are you listening? Or are you waiting and thinking of what you're going to say next?
Right.
If you're listening but really putting your attention more on the opportunity to say a word here, remembering other things, then you're not present at all in the conversation. And if you use that example, you can see that we do that with everything in life. We go through life completely in our own story, thinking what we're going to say, thinking what we're going to do, thinking what we did, but we're never really present in the moment. You can almost say, don't believe me, don't believe yourself, don't believe everyone else, but learn to listen. Basically saying, begin to listen to life. Begin to listen to life and don't pay too much attention to the filter that's stopping you from paying attention and experiencing life as is.
Right, and actually it's every moment we have to listen to life. Even when we think we're involved in a project or doing something important, life is always kind of readjusting us, you know? That's my feeling. So it's like, even when I think we're on track, we have to keep listening instead of going automatic.
You know, I think Bruce Lee said it right. We have to be like water.
Mm.
Be like water. Water fits and flows. When it goes into a certain, through a little stream or through a river, or wherever, if it's put into a flask, it always takes the shape that the flask is in. If it reaches an obstacle, the water will always find a way around.
Mm.
Be water. Always constantly flow. And like the best way to understand that, if we're not, we don't have that appreciation, is if we're completely stuck in one thing. It's like
No, I was trying to listen. No, I'm sorry. I'm just. But as I'm listening, you're stimulating certain points of interest. That, but then, you know, then I'm missing what else you're saying. So I'm just trying to practice what's being said here. And, you know, if I just drop in and see, I guess I want to know, is there a place that you want to get to all the time, like be present all the time? Or where's the whole apprenticeship and the teachings ultimately going for you and the people you're working with?
Our happiness.
Mm.
Life is to enjoy, completely enjoy every single moment.
Mm.
That's the whole point of this. Because from the moment we're born to the moment we die, we're the one who is constantly present in our life. Our mom and dad will be there for a while. Our children will show up, and hopefully they will outlast us, but sometimes they don't. The people we know, the people we love, everyone comes and goes. You can say death is always around us, giving and taking. But the one constant until we ourselves go is us, our own life, our own selves. So once we realize that, the whole concept of the one that we learn to in relationships, we're always constantly looking for the one, and we're always looking outside of ourselves. If we understand the concept that from the moment we're born to the moment we die, it's just me, then it makes me realize that I am the one. I'm the one whose relationship is the most important.
Mm.
And what am I going to do once I know that? Am I going to make myself happy, or am I make myself suffer? Or am I going to be really judgmental of myself or not loving myself the way I am? You know, we can go through life not accepting who we are, constantly nitpicking, constantly criticizing who we are. We can constantly judge ourselves. We can constantly say we weren't good enough, we weren't bad enough. Even if we do something good, it's like say, yay, Miguel, you reach all your goals. Yeah, but I'm not going to be able to make this. How can you focus on the great things to be able to accomplish if you're always focusing on the short ends? And the reason why we always focus on the short ends is because we're comfortable there.
Mm.
But if you're constantly enjoying who we are as is, the mere fact that we are perfect and that we're constantly in a beautiful dance with ourselves, wow, that is a beautiful, beautiful experience of life. To be able to really enjoy it. Because from this point of view, anyone who comes into contact with us, we're sharing ourselves with them. And it's such a great joy to be able to give what we have, which is love and acceptance for ourselves. How can we give what we don't have? If we don't accept ourselves, how can we accept anyone else? If we don't love ourselves...
Is that something you've gotten? Is that something you're still working with? How are you in that lesson?
Oh, I'm constantly practicing. You see, practice makes the master. And I'm going to practice it till the day I die. Because every day, there's always going to be a difference. Next morning, I may wake up with the inability to move my leg. And it's going to be a challenge to really accept myself the way it is, because, you know, the hurt and the issue, the challenge will be there. And if I practice and practice and practice, accept myself the way I am, then eventually I will do it. But the thing about it is, a great musician, a great athlete, you know, once they become a great athlete or a great musician, they don't stop practicing. And on the contrary, they continue to practice even more. Why? Because it's gotten to the point where even practicing is the real art. Because every time you practice, you know, you go through the basics, and all of a sudden, you find a new form of inspiration. You find a new form of expression. You know, if you're an athlete, you've been practicing going through all your drills or your drills or your drills. All of a sudden, you do your drill, but you did something slightly different, and it, you love the result. Hey, wonderful! All of a sudden, practice becomes the workshop. You know, like an artist's workshop. You know, because an artist will constantly, you know, for example, an artist will constantly, will, for one piece of art, there'll be a thousand sketches, studies, treatments, exercises, exercising the circle of the hand. You know, every morning there is that gesture going up and down, circle, triangles, painting here, painting there, to the point where you study, till it's like, okay, now I've mastered this color, now I've mastered this stroke, now I've mastered, let me combine them. Now that I have combined them, let me master this. All of a sudden, life is just a wonderful expression of art, and it's always in constant flow, because what was true a week ago is no longer true now. Why? Because, back then it only exists in my memory, and I only remember it through my point of view. Right now, right. Well, this is the only moment that is vast.
Well, I think what you're saying about the artist is really true. I've been studying the kind of what it is to be an artist, and I think if we can move into a culture where everybody is an artist, then we will have a peaceful culture. And I think that's where things like 2012 and the shift in consciousness and what this program I'm trying to do is all about. How do you feel where we're moving?
Well, you know, I think, and one of the reasons why, you know, the whole, my dad saw this in his own, because when you start really focusing on, you know, the mythology and the rites and the rituals, you basically just encapsulate yourself into one culture and one activity. But if you look at the way things are now, to encapsulate yourself in one culture, you're almost blocking yourself from the whole experience. We're in a position where all of the Earth's information is just a click away. You know, like we can be right now, you and I can be, we're in the different parts of one country, you and I. And if I wanted to, I can click on a computer, and at the same time I can multitask and start listening to someone and emailing someone in India or talking to someone in Japan. All of a sudden, the cultures, who we are, is almost seems that the countries just become our neighborhood. Yes, we come from them. Yes, we have their traits. Yes, we have the culture. We have the flavor. We have the music. We have the way to dance. We have the way to taste. But in this time of age where everything's becoming so open, it almost seems that we're heading towards a section where we all begin to blend, and it's beautiful.
That's where we're moving. Is that what you feel? I think we are moving on the planet.
And at the same time, you know, there's also fear. You know, I can't deny that there isn't fear. Of course there's fear. You know, just look at what's happening with the whole swine flu that's going around. All the fear that's coming on from that, you know, like the attention people are getting, you know, they're really...
Well, that's the media. You know, they pick up on economic depression, or they'll pick up on this
Can you imagine if the media existed during the French Revolution?
Exactly.
So you can only say, yes... The media is something new. It's 100 years old, and it's trying to pick up art. But those kind of situations, those fears, has been existing for a long time. If the French Revolution was televised,
it's human nature, and hopefully I think we're evolving to a higher place where we don't have to live by fear, but we can live by art and inspiration and imagination.
Yeah.
That's my hope. So tell me, you're coming to New York in June to do a big thing with your father and everybody else. Tell me what's happening there.
I didn't know I was going to New York. My dad was going to New York, and I think Jose is my brother. I would like to go to New York. My dad is right now. He's feeling much better. He suffered a massive heart attack in 2002. He functions with 35% of his heart, which is one of the reasons why he hasn't toured or traveled as much as he would love. Like in 2006, he was supposed to go to Europe and do a tour there. He was supposed to go through England, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. And his doctor says, if you go to Europe right now in your condition, you won't survive the airplane.
You're not gonna
touch land. So the doctor stopped him. Right now, my dad feels strong enough that he's pushing himself. And what's gonna happen in New York? Well, what's gonna happen is that my dad's gonna be there for the first time in a long time, and he's really looking forward to it.
And what exactly is he going to do? Is he going to do some ceremonies? Is he going to speak?
No ceremonies. We don't do ceremonies.
Okay.
Like once in a while, we'll do ceremonies. We did a ceremony 2 weeks ago in Zihuatanejo. Yeah, we did a workshop. Usually, those kind of ceremonies, we leave them for workshops and retreats, and only do them if it's something that was going to help them. And the thing about it is he's going to be doing a lecture and a workshop. I think he's going to be in New York, and it's going to be also, Rochester. He's going to be in Rochester as well. So I'm not really sure exactly what the course of the workshops are, but then again, we never know.
Right.
One of the things with us is that, you know, we always have a theme that we want to talk about, and we start out with theme. But the real direction that we end up in isn't really dictated by us. It's by the group, the ambiance that's there. Someone asks a question right before, or someone, you know, we pay attention to the people who are there. And it's really them who take us to where we're going to go. And it's beautiful.
I look forward to it. No, I appreciate your teachings, and so, you know, and your father's and the tradition that you're coming from, it really is uplifting people. And you're right, it's about getting out of the old rituals and just tapping into being happy and living your joy.
Exactly. For example, one wonderful meditation is like being able to run. You know, today I ran for 5 miles for the first time in my life. I've never run 5 miles. Today I ran 5 miles. You know, I noticed that the first mile, I was all in my head. I didn't know if I was even going to be able to make it. By the time I got into my second mile, I was in such a groove. My body knew what it was doing. By the third and fourth mile, it was almost bliss because I kept thinking. It was the equivalent of sitting down in a yoga position and meditating. It was like my body just knew. The last mile, I went back into my brain just wanting to finish that fifth mile because I've never done it. And the closer I got to my goal, the more excited I got. I was so excited about doing it. And then when I finished it, I raised my hands. I'm going, yeah, that was awesome. But it was one of the most beautiful meditations I have ever done.
Well, I know I've reached that place running too, where you're going to break through a wall and you just open up to a new place. Let's have another conversation at some point, okay?
Alan. It'll be my pleasure.
Okay, just leave people your website, because I have another guest that I'm supposed to call. But, yeah, how can people find you or, you know, the people you're working with, your father? What's the website?
Well, with the Ruiz family, we're all in miguelruiz.com. That's MiguelRuiz.com.
Uh-huh.
And you can also find my dad on Facebook. He's got a fan page. There's two pages on Facebook. One, it's an actual fan who created it, which is very nice. It's got an old picture of my dad. And then there's the one we created, which has a newer picture of my dad. So it's wonderful. And then pretty soon my dad is going to be doing webinars and lectures through the internet because one of the things that, because of his heart condition, we're trying to find ways for him to be able to reach out to more people, and eventually we're in the works for doing, for my dad to be able to be on the internet to do live classes.
Well, I'll announce that to people for sure.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for being a guest, and I'll be in touch. I'll hopefully see you if you come to New York. If you decide.
Well, do I hope I go to New York. If not, my dad will have a great time over there in Jose as well. All my love to you, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your teachings. I really appreciate that. Okay.
Thank you, and have fun.
I will. Thanks. I try to. Anyway, I've been talking to Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., and I have another guest coming up, Seth. I'm talking to the producer here at BBS. I have another number for this guest. Can I give that to you, Seth, at BBS? The next guest is a woman named Lil Allen, and she has an organization called Be Present, and I'm going to try to get her on the line. If the producer can make the connection there. Meanwhile, let me just see if I can just play a little song. Welcome back to New Realities. I'm here with Lily Allen, and she's going to be talking about her organization and her life, BePresent.org. So, Lily, my friend Jade has told me a lot about you, and she explained to me there was a sort of awakening that happened in you. Can you tell me a little bit about what your life has been about?
I think the Jade comment was about that, the statement about I've ended racism in my lifetime.
Oh, how did you ended it for yourself, you mean? Or?
Absolutely. I feel like in order for you to know what it looks like and know how you can do it, you first have to do it with yourself.
Uh-huh. How did you do that? How did you come to that idea of deciding to end racism for yourself?
Well, first of all, I'm part of a movement started with women and girls, and also have included and do include now men and boys. Mm-hmm. And Be Present is a national nonprofit organization which has been dedicated to building sustainable leadership for to be able to do social justice work. And so it comes through teaching what we call the Be Present Empowerment Model. Now, that model is with the work that started with me, which is how Be Present got started, and that was over 30-something years ago.
Mm. Well, why do you call it Be Present? Is it about just being present, or, I mean...
In the moment, right now, and the idea of it is that a lot of times that we are in relationships, a lot of relationships are always sometimes in reaction to the past.
Mm.
But to create something different and to be in relationships where you are in that moment right now, where that is the moment, is the reason why we call the work that the organization is called Be Present, because we're talking about creating relationships that is based on the present history and not a historical reality that we all experience through the issues of race, gender, power, and class, that we want the moment to be the moment by which we are able to create something different. And we and I do believe that that's the moment that has the best opportunity for creation of difference.
Well, that's what I'm interested in. How did you come up with the concept of be present?
Because my life, and that is that is the real truth. What happened that I'm my history is I'm African American, and I'm a migratory worker, and grew up in Pompano Beach, Florida. And I'm the oldest. I'm the youngest of 10 children, and the only one that finished college or graduate school. And it was three things that happened to me in my process that led me to start to do the work that is known through the organization as Be Present. First was when I went to undergraduate school, it was pretty much a predominantly black institution, and I was trying out for a majorette. And I was told that I was not going to make that because I wasn't, my hair wasn't long enough, my skin wasn't light enough, and I wasn't tall enough. And this was from and where I felt like one of the main things that was going to make it possible for me to be at school, at that school, was that I felt because I was black, that I, you know, that that's one of the things that was going to make it okay for me. So to find out that that didn't happen was really very disturbing. And something started to happen with inside of me. So I ended up at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and that was age of 24, and I had three children I was raising, and I had married and divorced, and I was late. I had applied to go to the school, got all of my, you know, the I was accepted into the school, but I didn't have any money. And it was after Labor Day, found out that there was a loan, a fellowship for a minority student. And I went to apply for that and ended up in that moment getting into school. And once I got into the school, and this is an all-white institution, I started to have in my head that there was something wrong with me because the majority of the people that was in that school was white, and I thought that they knew more than me, and it was internally in my head. And I, you have to remember, I'm 23. I've had, I raised my niece, and I have two of my own biological children. I had, what you would have said, I beat all the odds. But yet, I'm in this environment, and I didn't feel like I was okay, and I didn't trust what I knew, overstudied for an exam, and I went to take this exam and couldn't remember my name.
Wow.
And I never had that experience before in my life. And as a result of that, and it was a blessing in that moment, because as a result of that moment, I knew enough to know I was in trouble. And I left that class and ended up at a woman's house who, woman named auntie, an older woman, and who knew me, and I was there hollering and screaming in a way that she had never witnessed me before. And she asked me what was wrong, and I told her I didn't know my name. And, of course, she looked at me pretty strange and said, your name is Pearl. That's my middle name. And she gave me a beer and a cigarette, and she died this past January, but in 90-something years of age. But and she gave me that beer, and she set me down, and then I was telling her how I didn't know. I didn't feel like I was smart enough. I didn't feel like I was okay. And then, of course, she looked at me crazy. She said, you go back to that school. And I did go back. But when I did, one of the things that I knew at that moment was that here I was. I had three children. I felt like I'd gone to college, and here I was in graduate school at the number one school of public health. And if you think about it, I should have been feeling really great about myself, but I really did not. That in that process that I started to shut down, when I went to when I, undergraduate school, happened over a period of time. And even though I had accomplished a lot, what I lost was my own sense of self. And it was at that moment that I started to ask myself the question, if I was going to raise my children and I was going to talk about how to bring them into being in this culture when I myself didn't feel okay. I needed to do something different. And it was that process, it was at that time that I asked the question, I'm like, how did I get to know my core self, not just somebody's daughter or somebody's best friend or, you know, but how do I get to know the core of my being? And not only that, how do I sustain it? I didn't want to just know it. I wanted to sustain it. And then how do I get to know other people that also, not just from the places that we had to survive, but just really get to know them from that core place of being? And then how do we build something different? How do I create something different? And that was just the beginning of those questions. Those were simple questions. I was studying for a Master's of Public Health. So I was blessed enough to start that process with a group of young people in Chapel Hill, North Carolina at that time, and spent the first 10 years just doing some incredible looking and not judging, but looking and paying attention to how there were incredible systems of support that was set up to, quote, help people, but there was a disconnect for those who were in the position to help and those to receive. And I also recognize that we live in a culture where most of the system is informed, which is important, but information alone doesn't change. And if we were going to absolutely have a way to create a culture that embraces all of us, we had to have a different process for people to be involved in. So after I spent about 10 years of just doing different kind of work with different groups that was struggling on a lot of basis around how do you come together and how do you work across those differences and how do you stay whole, I ended up in 1981 being part of a group of black women who were looking at the health issues. And 2 years of work with that core group, we put on a conference in 1983 at Spelman, and at that conference I did this work with black women in a workshop called Black and Female, What is the Reality? And that workshop had all the participants that came to that conference was over 1,900.
Wow.
Over half of those came to that work. It was clearly that it was something that people were seeking to. So, and then in 1988, the group of black women, along with white women and other women of color, got together, and again, it was from another person, a white woman, who was saying that, you know, I've seen this working, and I really do want to be able to look at how to work with other whites around the issues of race. And what I said is that why don't we all come together from the different places and use this process as a way to answer some of the questions that we're struggling with.
Wait, but what's the process? Because I sort of miss, because I think the self-inquiry, what is the core of my being, that's something I'd like to know more about. And is that part of the process you're talking about?
It was, yes. The Be Present Empowerment model is what I'm talking about. And it's a circle of process that you're in. First step to that is to get to know who you are that's not based on a history of oppression.
How do you do? How do you know who you are? I mean, even without oppression, or how do you know who you are without any stories at all, right?
Well, the thing about it is that, early on, a lot of people do know who they are, and they know who they are based on the history by which they had to live. But if you are, have an opportunity to create the environment, which we bring together people coming from different backgrounds to be able to sit together, where for the first time in most people's lives that they actually get to be listened to, which is the next part of this process, is that if you are able to listen to someone when they are not just what they are saying, but if you listen to where they are in it, what they're saying, it starts to create a different kind of knowing. So so that's why the practice of it is important. For me, first of all, I had to know for myself, how do I what is the process that I go through to be able to get to know that? And for me, I was in isolation because it was a question I was asking, but the way that I had to do it was that you know your truth. I don't care what you tell anybody else. There's a truth that you fundamentally that everybody do know.
Mm-hmm. And what's the rest of the process? We don't have that much time, but
right.
I'd like
that's
to hear the whole process because it sounds very interesting.
Is knowing yourself outside of the distress of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
An important step that you really do have to get to know the core of your being. And that dysfunction that's not based on how you had to react or be in reaction to the ways that you were not allowed to be. The second
right.
step is listening to each other in a very present and conscious state. Now, that's a critical step. And that step does come after the first step. That once you get ready to, once you can open up yourself to be able to hear something, you start to hear something different. When
right.
you start to hear something different, that takes us to that next place of a building, which is building the relationship, a sustainable relationship, and you build something different that is not based on that history. And it's from that you can start to create a whole way of being.
A relationship with who do we build with?
First of all, you have to build a relationship with yourself.
Uh-huh.
Because you haven't been in your own relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But that also helps you build a relationship with other people outside of yourself. So whether, and a lot of the work will be present, is to look at the issues of race, gender, power, and class. Because you start to create a different way of being with people around those issues. When
mm-hmm.
you have a chance to sit to know where you are in it, being able to see something different with someone else who's also in that same process, then you'll create a whole different way of being.
Mm-hmm. Do you just eventually forget about the issues of race, gender, class, all that? Like, I mean, the people become transparent in a way. They no longer have gender, race, or class, or any of the things that separate us.
I think that's the key. It's the separation of that. It's not
yeah.
that we don't want to have those things,
mm-hmm.
but we don't need the ways that we had to be in them in the society. We don't need to be separated because of the misinformation, the lack of information, or no information at all, create
mm-hmm.
situations that gets you to build a whole different way. So it's not that we don't want to know someone who are of a different race, but we need
mm-hmm.
to be in that relationship different with them in celebration.
Of the difference.
Yes, that we're trying to create different ways to be with people that does not keep us always divided and often make our collective agenda not effective.
Right, so on one level we transcend it, but we also acknowledge who we are as gender, race, class.
Absolutely.
You know?
We want a different
right.
history. We want to be in celebration.
Mm.
Of having a different way to be. I truly believe that my journey is not unique.
Mm-hmm.
I feel
we
have had histories where and people before who always believed that there was something greater than what had divided us around the issues.
Mm.
What my journey did was made it more visible and finding other people who also believe that.
Mm. So your organization now, BePresent.org, is involved in connecting with more and more people around the planet? Is that what's happening?
Yes, we take the Be Present Empowerment model. We provide training and also other support of building people who are interested in looking at how to create something different. We work with other groups, social justice groups that is also interested in building their capacities to be able to have the kind of work that they need to have so that they can have something different also in what they are doing. And we also work with, you know, partnerships. So we work with a lot of different groups that are also interested, who have a similar interest in changing fundamentally how they are in relationships. So we are a national group that are based in Atlanta, but we also have a group. I'm here in New York, so we have a Sisters and Allies Leadership Project that's here in New York, and we have one in Philadelphia. We have one in the Bay Area, Oakland. We are organizing also in Chicago and Santa Cruz and Arizona, Seattle. So we are pretty much trying to move as many places we can to bring this model to many groups, especially during the time that we're in right now.
Right. Why? What's this time about, do you feel?
Everybody's talking about change.
Right.
And the systems being different. And I'm excited because we as a people really get a chance to be in that system differently. And I think what Be Present bring to the right now is almost 40 years of creating the kind of change that everybody is really are in right now.
It's exciting, isn't it, that we're
I'm so excited.
And you like Obama, huh, as part of the leadership?
I'm so happy. I'm for a lot of reasons. First of all, that, you know, I'm African-American.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, it means a lot to me to see the visibility, you know, mm-hmm. of him. And at the same mm-hmm. time, what is so wonderful is that it took a lot more people to mm-hmm. make him the president. And that is such an incredible statement of the country we live in. It already has changed itself.
It is. People are changing just by that symbol of a renewed hope. So
absolutely. And this is the opportunity for us to be able to sit those tables where we can bring a voice of what that change should look like. And so what President Barack talked about is that he needs all of us to be involved in that process. I'm very excited that started for Be Present 30-something years ago.
Well, so thank you for all your work, Lily, and your organization, Be Present. Hopefully we can talk more on future shows, okay?
I would love to do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is New Reality. So if you want to find me, you can go to newrealities.com. And it's really a show about what you're talking about and also a whole spiritual evolution that I feel is happening in many different ways, including what you're doing. So
I would love to be able to be back on again. I would love for Jade to come because Jade has an incredible story.
I know. We'll talk to Jade, too.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you
so much.
Okay, I appreciate it. And I'll see you when you're in New York.
Yes, we can work
right.
that out.
Okay, I'm going to end with this song called The Song of the Soul.
Wow. Thank you.
Thanks. And my name's, I just say goodbye to the audience saying my name is Alan Steinfeld and this is New Realities and you can find me at newrealities.com. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.